Hey, welcome to Coin Talk. We talked to our new friend, Tony Shang. I wrote a piece recently about this book, about the psychology of mass movements, what it might say about crypto. We also talked some news. We, being myself, Aaron Lammer, and my co-host, Jay Kang, brought to you in partnership with Medium. Medium makes it easy to find great writing about crypto, and if you enjoy it, you should become a member. It's $5 a month. It unlocks all kinds of great writing, transcripts of this show, which are at medium.com/cointalk. Here's the show.
This episode of Coin Talk was taped Wednesday, September 5th at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. The Bitcoin price index was $6,686.
Jay, it has been a while.
Yeah, I mean, it hasn't been that long since we've released episodes, but it's been a while, yeah.
Well, we had them a bit stacked up. In that period, in the first run of the show, Bitcoin would have gone up like $2,500. Instead, it's probably down $200.
It would have gone up and then gone down a tiny bit and then gone up again, and we would have been mad at one another for not buying the so-called dip when it like went from like 14,000 to 13,500. We're like, oh, yeah. I should have bought that dip.
When I bought that dip of Ethereum at 1,100, that was just great. That was a great move. Yeah.
I think I bought that too. I think it was like a 1040 and I was like, it can't go any lower than
always that. Buy the dip, Jay. Always buy the dip.
Always buy the dip.
Tons of news since we've last talked. Could barely hold my horses on some of this stuff. First up, I think we have to, because of the nature of this podcast, I think we have to talk about the prophecy.
What is the prophecy?
So if you spend a lot of time on crypto Twitter, which I really don't recommend that you do, but there's kind of like a core group of sort of like shit talker, developer, investor, analyst kind of people. Anyway, one of them is this guy Romano, who's behind Viacoin. Do you remember, we were Viacoin heads?
Yeah, I think that was like your first. I feel like it was your first love before SumoCoin took your heart. It was. I remember you telling me all the time about Viacoin.
I remember the very first thing when I told our friend Ledger Status that I was in Camp Via. He was like, "Isn't that made by some kid who's like 21?" And I was like, "What?"
Is that true? Is the kid 21?
Yeah. So Romano is the developer behind Viacoin. I think he lives in the Netherlands in Utrecht. I don't really recommend you like follow his Twitter unless you're like comfortable with some fairly problematic libertarian crypto views. But that goes with the territory.
Shocking, yeah.
That goes with the territory. That was what I previously knew Romano as. But some of, I think actually Crypto Messiah, who I think also knows Ledger Status, was giving him shit about being like literally, I think 21 or 22 years old, and was like, you've never eaten ass, right? And he was like, yeah. No. And then somehow this went into a like larger snowballing phenomenon that the only way that they could end the winter for alts was to convince Romano to eat bud.
Can I ask you a question?
Like, yes.
You and I are about the same age.
Yes.
And,
how did it take to the 44th episode for me to use the phrase eat bud on the show? I don't know.
No. Like, what is going on with this eating ass trend? I mean, I first noticed it when I was writing about Barstool Sports and I sort of followed all their Instagram feeds. They have like 40 different Instagram feeds.
Yeah.
And it was all like, there's just this, like, there seemed to be amongst college kids, especially in the South, because they have a lot of, they have this thing called Old Row, which I think is like a Southern fraternity Instagram account.
Yeah.
And every other post was about eating ass. And I was just like, what is going on with this?
I think Ledger is from, if we want a question about how did ass eating get so popular in the American South, that we need to save that for the Ledger Status, get him back on the show, which I'm very eager to do. And I think he probably has some thoughts on the issue. Do I have an explanation for the popularity of ass eating on the post-millennial internet? I don't think I do, But I'll say when the story happened, it wasn't like, it didn't like shock me. I was like, okay, there was going to have to be some kind of a crazy event to pull crypto out of its slumber. And this seemed like an appropriate one. It seemed modern.
Okay. Is there like an overlap between the ass eating meme and Pepe memes? Like, are they in concert at all? I'm trying to figure it out.
I think you actually just invented a conspiracy theory, but I think the younger generation's interest in ass eating is bipartisan across all sorts of cultural spheres. It's not just like a Pepe thing.
Sure.
The woke kids are talking about butt eating also. So Romano was, I believe, flown on someone else's dime from his hometown to Las Vegas, where a porn actor, that seems weird if I say actor because of the gender implications, but a woman porn actor who is active in the blockchain world, and him consummated this prophecy.
I won't plead. Full ignorance of this. I saw some of the photos that were going around.
I'll plead full ignorance, other than looking at photographs.
But it also it seemed to actually crack some of the more national crypto news, right? Like, I don't really know what that means, but I think The Verge or The Outline wrote about it as well.
Yeah, so. I think Motherboard. Romano had tweeted a photograph from the editor of Motherboard getting in touch. I'll admit that I did send him an email inviting him to come on the show and talk about it. I've not heard a response. It did cause the markets to wake up. There was like a 10% plus alt run within 24 hours of this happening. And I'll say that I actually thought that this had set off the rocket from the bottom.
Well, it did actually. I mean, it was great marketing for Viacoin, I guess. Do you still have yours?
I don't. And I believe that the woman involved, I think her name is Brenna Sparks, is an advisor to or somehow part of the Spank Chain project. A good look for Spank Chain also. Viacoin, I think, was up like 17% that day. So regardless of what we think about Romano, he did a service for his project. It's more than some of the developers out there are doing for their coin.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I don't really see too much wrong with this.
Yeah.
Two consenting adults trying to snap the alt winner. Like, there's, you know, if it works, it works. But I don't know. I still can't quite get over my confusion about this, you know, why everyone talks about ass eating.
It's a bummer that you're no longer with Vice News, because I do think that this is the kind of millennial hard-hitting reporting that would have worked there, where you could have investigated how did butt eating get so popular among the kids.
Yeah.
So I assume that this won't be the last time someone tries to jumpstart the alt market by eating ass.
I feel like they have to go further now, you know?
I know. That's what I'm worried about. It's almost more dangerous if this works, because you jumpstart a series of one-upmanship starting there.
It's like when rap went into the horrorcore like era. Do you remember that?
Like Gravediggers? Like,
well, the Gravediggers put out what I think is an iconic and very good album. And then the Swollen Members like put out even more horrorcore, which is really just about like killing people. Like, the whole thing was just about brutally murdering people, especially women. And then, it feels like, you know, at some point it's going to have to peter out, just like horrorcore rap did. I don't even know. I mean, horrorcore rap, though, you know, at least it was interesting. I'll also defend horrorcore rap. I'm in a very generous mood today.
This totally is a podcast about cryptocurrencies.
I feel like the people who are our age who went through horrorcore rap, who are into cryptocurrency right now, will all defend horrorcore rap. There's no one who will condemn it.
there's only one person who even knows what you're talking about, and that's me. Okay, so also in the news this week, I'm going to file this under, I feel like we need like a name for this, news that seems like it should be a big deal, but that no one gave a shit about.
Yeah, so basically anything that's not about the markets, eating, or excerptoshi, I would say.
Yeah, it's like it's kind of like a red herring. Like, I would love if, you know how like things happen during the NFL week before that move the line? you know, news comes out, injuries and whatnot. And it would be interesting to study those and have gambling handicappers say, like, this is how much it's going to move the line. You know what I mean? Like, I'll give an example. Khalil Mack on the Raiders right now. Like, what does it move the Raiders, like, win over under if he does or does not play this season, you know? And that's something that you could debate amongst people who really know odds. This piece of news with Ethereum is something that I thought would have a big positive effect on the market. And as we are taping this, Ethereum is reaching a full wet bed, $226 right now. I never thought I would see this day.
It's in range for FOMO Kang.
Jay, how did I decide to go all like deep into Ethereum on the way down? It's something I'll never understand.
I don't know, but like it's something that I thought about when you were doing it because it coincided with us trying and unsuccessfully signing into Augur. Remember that? Like it was around the time where like you were like, well, wow, Ethereum has a product now, but it doesn't work. And I was like, well, that's not good. And then you're like, yeah, but it's like, you don't understand open source software and beta products. And I was like, and I don't. However, it's not good that it doesn't work. And then your response was to buy more Ethereum. I didn't question it at the time because I don't, you know, I generally am so checked out of the market that, you know, I felt like maybe you had some justification.
Well, look, I don't pretend to know exactly what's going on in Ethereum. I think Ledger Status's explanation that no one gives a shit about ICOs is the biggest thing to keep in the front of your mind. But Ethereum has these, like, I think four stages in its evolution. The newest one is Constantinople. So they were doing a call with the developers. The developers basically said, as part of the Constantinople upgrade, that the block reward for Ethereum was going down to 2 ETH, which means less Ethereum than expected is getting injected into the Ethereum ecosystem in 2019. And it also means that the difficulty bomb, which is looming out in the future in Ethereum, is being deferred 1 year, as I understand it.
Okay, so I have a good term for this type of news, which is shit we would have cared about in the summer of 2017.
Yes. I would say right up until fall 2017.
Because like Constantinople was talked about on Ethereum Reddit boards last year, you know, right when we got into crypto. They're like, well, Metropolis is going to happen, and then Constantinople. And, you know, it's interesting. It sort of made it seem like the people who were designing Ethereum were using the same vocabulary as, like, Civilization, you know, the game Civilization upgrade, you know, like expansion packs. But this stuff doesn't matter anymore. And it's really strange because I would say a year ago when all of us were much more hopeful and trying to learn the tech and before crypto had become just kind of a funny meme generator, that we did care about technological things like this, even if we didn't fully understand them. Like I read a lot about Metropolis and Constantinople and, you know, like what Vitalik's plans were. And I would say I probably understood about 25% of what I read, but the 25% I understood made me very, very bullish about the future of Ethereum because it seemed like there was a real tech team that was working on it. And Now this stuff is being realized, which it should be important, but it is, I agree that it is strange that it seems like nobody cares about it. You know, like I understand why, like the people who, you know, crypto moderates like you or me, or, you know, people who have Pepe avatars in there, you know, and just sort of post charts and shit post all day. Like I get why we don't care about it. But the thing that I don't quite understand is why, like, institutional investors who are very interested in the technological part of it, like, why don't they care about it? You know, like, and why isn't that, if they do, why isn't that reflected in the price at all?
Well, look, I don't, you know, we've talked many times on this show about how Bitcoin does what it's going to do now. And Ethereum is this bet on an increasingly complicated future. And I guess in lieu of something that makes you excited about that future, I'm not sure that it's enough to say like the economics are tilting in favor of ETH holding right now. Like it's facing an existential crisis in which failure is like total failure, not like, oh, it's helpful that there's like a lower supply. in that thing. And it's possible we're being overly caustic. I feel like Ethereum's a little bit like a team that like went like 0-3 and you're like, it's all over. They should end the franchise, fire everyone. And it's like, okay, like another way to read this is that the entire market is in a horrible, horrible bear cycle. Everyone's more violent than Bitcoin. And there's nothing special about Ethereum.
Yeah. I think you're right.
Yeah. I mean, look, I would say me and you understand Ethereum the least of any of the worlds. It's always been an opaque mystery to us. Perhaps that's why it's particularly mystifying that I've included so much of it in my portfolio. but I would say we are reaching peak existential, playing death in chess in the seventh seal Ethereum world right now.
Well, okay. Can I ask you a question?
Sure.
Like, why did you swap out a lot of your Bitcoin holdings for Ethereum over the past couple of weeks?
Completely neophyte thinking, which is just, if you're in crypto right now, you believe that crypto markets are going to come back. And my dumb belief is that they'll come back more or less like they were. And if they go back more or less to where they were, or at least in that general trajectory, Ethereum will gain a bunch on Bitcoin because it's traded much higher against Bitcoin in the past. Assuming that all these fundamentals are kind of like unchanged, that's my hope, is that we just pull back the clock to, let's say like October 2017, and that move looks smart.
So there's like a, you see crypto as Groundhog Day.
Yeah, it's like a nostalgia. That's all I think is going to happen is what already happened.
At some point, the same spike that happened yesterday will happen today. And this time you'll remember to sell Ethereum at like 1200.
I mean, I probably will continually trade that Ethereum for Bitcoin if and when Ethereum recovers against Bitcoin. But I would have never in a million years imagined that it would fall this far in relation to Bitcoin. So at this point, I don't think I know anything.
Yeah, it's strange to me. I remember that at some point I was like at a conference and there was a guy there who happened to be wearing like a crypto t-shirt. And I asked him, and he seemed very knowledgeable about it and very smart. And he just said, like, I don't ever think that Ethereum is going to be able to scale to be usable at any sort of level. And I wonder, given the fact that, you know, these projects that have launched have had sort of rough starts in terms of usability, things like just, you know, like sort of syncing to the blockchain or even, you know, making something functional that doesn't take forever. I wonder if that's the, if people who are smarter than you or I, who want to make big investments, I wonder if that, if stuff like that is concerning to them. Like, I wonder if there is a technological reason why people are not really just throwing all their money into this thing.
Oh, wait, I think I remember the other reason why I bought a bunch of Ethereum, which was, no matter how much I've talked spicy about the power structures of Silicon Valley, I also don't bet against them. And the fact that there's a concerted core emanating from Coinbase and moving through the VC world that I think wants Ethereum to win, it's at least enough to make me think that's an interesting at the bottom play into it, that I just don't see these guys being like, that's it for Ethereum.
So you saw Ethereum sort of as like almost an ETF to buy into interesting new Silicon Valley projects that might be using Ethereum. Like, it is the catch-all.
No, I think I mean literally just like, even if Ethereum doesn't know what it's doing right now, there's just a bunch of people with deep pockets who are willing to keep experimenting with
it. No, that's what I mean. Yeah. Like, it's like I like, as part of my dumb portfolio, not crypto portfolio, but stocks portfolio, I own this ETF called IPOs, which is, you know, I don't know much of it because it's so dumb, but it's an ETF of all the IPOs that happen. So like, buying Ethereum would, in your mind, is kind of like that.
Yeah.
Like, catch off any project that might be successful.
Well, but the weird thing is that was what I think Ethereum was doing in the last bull run, which was catching all the momentum of all of the ICOs that were built on top of it. We're in an extremely bad climate, I think, right now, at least from a public perception standpoint around ICOs. And I think that's probably what stopped the momentum. And my hope is that Silicon Valley, with its very deep pockets, and I think very talented people, honestly, will find a different approach to making Ethereum work. I don't know that the ICO, like utility ERC-20 token approach worked. I think right now I'd call that a failure, but I think that using the very basic idea of smart contracts, I'm hoping that the smart minds of Silicon Valley can create some product of value. And I'm willing to bet they're going to keep ramming their head against the door, trying for a bit longer, which makes it maybe okay to buy a little ETH now. I'm not really sure.
Wow, Ethereum is really not doing well right now, huh?
I mean, it's really bad. I mean, another way to think about this from a really dumb investor's math perspective is just, if we got to all-time highs again for everything, that's like more than a 6x for Ethereum, while it's like a 2 or 3x for Bitcoin.
3x, yeah.
3x. So yeah, that's like...
Well, no, not really. It's like 2.5 or something.
Yeah, 2.5. And I think, to me, I call the Bitcoin high 15,000. Everything above 15,000 may have been some sort of like weird smoke and mirrors. I know that you think like everything above 2,000 may have been smoke and mirrors, but okay. One more piece of news from the week.
Sure.
So do you know what Shapeshift and Changely are?
Yeah. It's the Shapeshift is the protocol that apparently stole a Monero from you, right? Or two Monero from you.
I won't say they stole them.
Steal is a strong word. But yes,
that's like saying that like United Baggage stole your bag rather than lost your bag. They lost my two Monero bag. But the way these things basically work, they're actually like, I think, one of the better products out there in crypto. They're pretty simple.
I agree too.
You send them one currency, they create an anonymized address that then sends you back a different currency. So rather than going through an exchange, you can basically do this very lightweight transaction. It's almost like you send an email and you get back an email. And except when that email gets lost, which I'm going to say probably was my own fault, it's a pretty cool service.
Yeah, I actually remember I used it like while we were recording your other podcast, the long form podcast. And before we recorded, I was like, Aaron, I need to buy some altcoins because Bitcoin is too boring. And you showed me how to use Shapeshift. I think I bought some Zcash.
Yeah.
And it was very easy. I mean, it took longer than I had hoped, but you know, that's just crypto. But I exchanged some Bitcoin for Zcash and it worked perfectly.
Compared to our experiences with something like Augur, which listeners can go back to, where it was like 9 steps, this node wouldn't sync. Shapeshift and Changely operate like first class products. You just like go to them. It's a nicely designed website. Everything works. The FAQ makes sense. But as with many schemes like this, you have to wonder, like, other than people who are dabblers like ourselves, like, who's using this? This seems pretty money laundering-y.
Yeah, well, the way in which it's been discussed since that time when we first learned about it is that whenever we talk to people about how crypto is really traceable, or how we get emails or we get tweets saying, well, you could just shapeshift it, you know? And it seems like the way in which it's in the ecosystem is as a way for people to sort of change and make things untraceable.
Yeah, and you can basically see, I don't think you can see how you can totally avoid know your customer regulations with it, because they don't allow fiat swaps. So you need Bitcoin in the first place. But once you have the Bitcoin, you can operate totally anonymously within the Shapeshift and Changely environments, which means that once you have money in Bitcoin, you can pretty effectively get rid of any sort of a trace of where it went through a series of Shapeshift or Changely transactions. And obviously, some people are using this to obscure their tracks. And both companies in the last week or two have made changes that seem like they're to address this. So Shapeshift's change is that they're introducing some sort of a membership tier where to really fully use their service or to use it the most efficiently at the best rate, you have to become a member, which involves giving up your identity. And
oh, wow.
this has been pretty highly controversial, I think, within the shapeshift community.
Is there a shapeshift community?
I think so, yeah. I mean, Eric Voorhees, and I feel like he has kind of like his people.
Sure, Eric Voorhees being, I think he's the first person mentioned in Nathaniel Popper's book. I mean, it's a guy who's been in the crypto space since the beginning, basically. A guy who has made a lot of money and a lot of impact in the space. So, he came out and made a statement about this?
It's on the Shapeshift blog. He says, the final point, there's five levels of membership, much like we've talked about Binance's BNB. There's like a loyalty system, benefits, trading limits, et cetera, at various tiers of membership, discounts on rates, et cetera. But the final point is, membership requires basic personal information to be collected. Today, membership is optional, but it will become mandatory soon. And then he says, yes, that last detail sucks. We would prefer if the collection of personal information was not a mandatory element. We still firmly believe that individuals, regardless of their race, religion, or nationality, deserve the right to financial privacy, just as Thank they you. Deserve the right to privacy in their thoughts and their relations. Blah, I can't finish this sentence. Anyway, so basically he's saying, we'd all like this to be anonymous, but it's not going to be anonymous anymore. It's going to be like an exchange. You're going to need to reveal your real identity if you want to use Shapeshift.
Is someone leaning on him? I mean, did he get a call from the SEC or something like that? So he doesn't say
he was threatened or anything like that. But I do feel like he, in this message, is basically suggesting this is the right move for this business.
Well, I mean, like all things in crypto, it seems like they did also create a coin around this. I'm just reading the Bloomberg article about this, which it says, Voorhees said Shapeshift's membership program will be tiered in five levels. You just said that. The most basic level is free and open to everyone, and levels 2 to 5 will give users benefit in exchange for, quote, possession of specific amounts of Fox tokens, an Ethereum-based digital coin.
Not bad. I do like Fox. They have a good logo.
So once again, we've sort of created a, I mean, I really doubt that Voorhees is doing this to try and shill the Fox token. And it seems like the timing between this and Changely might mean that somebody is quietly leaning on them. It is kind of nice to know that anytime a crypto company changes, that one thing that will happen is that they will create a currency or use a currency to do something that probably is not necessary.
All right. Two conflicting ideas here. One, he says, on one hand, this is something that our users have requested to be able to have an account history. And in that sense, I understand what he's saying. It's very difficult to run totally anonymized services. You got people like me who've lost to Monero and are walking around with a grudge forever. Mm-hmm. And if I had an account, I could probably like more easily solve that. So I understand that. But he also says, to the extent that digital asset technology remains a legal gray area, we need to be prudent and thoughtful in our approach as we navigate the regulatory environment. And that just says to me, you're not allowed to do this. Like, you're never going to be like a first-rate, big, successful American business running a service that does business with anonymous cryptocurrencies. And that's also the theme with Changely, which says that it's been flagging suspicious Monero transactions in the system. So when someone sends a bunch of one currency and gets back a bunch of Monero, if it checks off certain flags for them, they will hold the transaction until you can go through some sort of an approval process, which sounds a lot like a know your customer process.
Does that mean that right now that this generation, you know, there's one generation Bitcoin seen anonymous. Now we have another. Then we had a whole generation of supposedly anonymous shit coins,
yeah,
or altcoins that now seem to be kind of beating back. Does that mean that right now there's probably just like a cryptocurrency that nobody knows about, or perhaps one that's in development that is being used for these markets now? Because like, I know that Changely putting up this policy doesn't necessarily change the way in which people are going to use Monero. It's just one exchange. It's just one method of doing this, same as Shapeshift. But, you know, if this is part of a trend where the larger companies that handle these sorts of transactions are going to become less and less friendly to anonymous users, I wonder if that just means that there's a new generation of crypto coming, because you know, the only thing that's going to spark this sort of actual usable and utilitarian innovation here would be the fact that the last generation of anonymous stuff isn't quite as anonymous anymore.
I mean, I read it the opposite way, which is it seems like that market has so closely aligned itself around Monero that rather than outlaw the entire practice of shapeshift changely transactions, they're just like, no, it's okay, just not Monero. And they make a big thing about how it's like, they don't have a problem with Monero, there's nothing wrong with Monero, but they're not flagging Zcash transactions. They're just flagging Monero transactions. And the crazy part is, if you get a transaction flagged with Changely and you can't provide the necessary documentation, they don't refund your money. They just keep it.
Oh my God.
So they're basically saying anonymously change large amounts into Monero at your own peril. We're not supporting this on the level we support our other products because it's such a problem.
Huh. So it does mean that, I kind of agree with you then. It means that Monero actually is a problem.
Yeah, I mean, all this stuff seems like it would be wildly bullish for Monero. Monero did have a really great week.
Well, I mean, bullish if you need to make a fully anonymous transaction.
Well, I mean, it's a real use case for Monero that suggests not only that there's a use case, but people are using it in enough volume that these kind of services are seeing a pattern of this kind of usage. But on the other hand, if you can't do anonymous Monero transactions, if you can't get on an exchange without turning over your driver's license, Monero remains anonymous, but there's no real anonymous acquisition route for Monero. Like, I do see a pretty clear path to where government can wall in a currency like Monero and say, well, we haven't banned it outright, but we've made it impossible for any of these companies to use it.
Well, I mean, you could still get it in different ways, right? Like, you could have somebody bring you a flash drive with it.
I mean, there's always going to be local Monero, but you're never going to like grow on like a Bitcoin scale without in some ways making it possible for people to buy your coin online, I think.
Yeah, but maybe that's not its future, you know?
No, maybe there's going to be some like Tahitian island that figures out how to sell people in Monero anonymously, and it's only these American businesses that have a problem with it.
Yeah, I mean, I just feel like the demand for it, for that type of thing, is just so high.
Yeah.
And, you know, for everything from funding Al Qaeda to, you know, like buying credit card information.
Dave, we're a pro Monero show. Pro Monero.
In terms of Monero's uses, I mean, as long as people need to send money to do those types of things, then, you know, there's going to be a need for it. And if it's working, then it's working. And, you know, I imagine that for the people who run Monero, that, you know, they feel pretty conflicted about it, or maybe they don't, but, you know, I don't think so.
That dude has a $1 million watch.
That's true.
Okay. This is a good one. Should we call our guest?
Yeah.
Welcome, Tony Shang.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Jay just asked what you did for a living, and I tried to describe it, and he was like, I think I'll just ask him. So before we start talking about the more esoteric topics, you work in the blockchain world.
That's right.
Tell us about the project you work on.
So I lead product on a project called Decentraland, which is an open virtual world owned by its users. You can kind of think of it like if you know Minecraft or Roblox or something like that. Rather than have everybody have their own server, you have one big world. And as a user, you walk around and all of it loads dynamically. So it's pretty novel. And the only way that you're able to do that is to issue the property itself as tokens. We built it on top of Ethereum, but you could do it on other blockchains as well.
Does that satisfy you, Jay?
No. What are you buying? Is it like Second Life and you're buying like a house in it, or what are you actually buying?
Yeah, it's kind of like that. I mean, so we build kind of the protocol layer of this. So it starts off with land. The world is represented by 90,000 parcels of land, and those are non-fungible tokens on top of Ethereum. So we did an initial auction of that. Now, you know, thousands of people own these parcels of land. Some of them own a lot of them contiguously so they can build larger experiences. With land, you can upload web VR experiences to the land. So that starts to appear in the world when people walk around.
Yeah. It is like a sort of amusement park then, or like a department store.
And it's really up to the user what they want to do. It's like a website. I can't really.
Yeah, that makes sense.
It's like calling the web an amusement park.
Yeah. Cool. It's interesting, these metaphors. We were talking earlier in the show about like the Ethereum builds being named like Constantinople is the next one, and how this feeling kind of like echoes these like classic video games, like a sort of civilization like outlook. And it's just interesting to me, like how different games contribute to like what we imagine these things as. I was like thinking of like, for some reason, Myst when you were talking about it. But then when you just said like websites, I was like, oh yeah, like you can build anything on top of anything.
Yeah, totally. So yeah, there are definitely people building stuff that would be more like Myst, but other people want to build like furniture stores.
Were you previously a developer and then got interested in the blockchain, or did you get interested in decentralized kind of stuff and decide you wanted to build up a skill for it?
Yeah, so my background's mostly in product and startups. So most recently I worked at Google. Before that, I was a startup called AltSpace VR, which was an early social VR app.
Yeah.
Before that, some enterprise stuff. And I'm not an engineer by trade. I'm like a really bad programmer, but...
Same. I'm with you.
Yeah.
It's funny because I feel like certain times people have the impression that like anyone who dedicated enough time could like learn to be an effective software developer. And I'm like, nope, couldn't do it. Much like professional sports, I would be very bad at this. I would never do this on a high enough level to be employed doing it.
Yeah, totally.
So what got you interested? You write about Bitcoin and decentralized currencies on your blog, which is how I first came across you. But I'm assuming your interest goes back before you were writing about it.
Yeah, so I went to kind of a nerd high school. It was called the Math and Science Academy, Illinois Math and Science Academy. So a lot of folks that I went to school with actually ended up being pretty early folks on Bitcoin and Ethereum. So I was exposed to it pretty early on, but just thought it was kind of nerd stuff. And then in college, my roommate was from Venezuela freshman year. So I got some exposure to what it's like to have family live in a country that has really poor monetary policy. So that kind of made me take a second look at Bitcoin. I was like, whoa, this isn't just weird magic internet money. It's weird magic internet money that people might prefer over their state issued currency. So I picked some up around then and then just kind of watched it. But with Ethereum, like as I mentioned, my background's in apps. So I was like, oh, I can make some stuff on Ethereum. And that's kind of when I started digging in more deeply and got involved with the community, met up with Ari and Esteban, the founders of Decentraland. And yeah, ever since then, it's just been, I mean, there's just so much to explore in the space. So it's just gotten more and more of a commitment to the space.
It's funny. Sometimes I think part of why Ethereum holds such a sway over people in San Francisco and in Silicon Valley is just when you imagine that future, there's a bunch of opportunity to build like software products. And you're talking about a community of people whose number one like hobby and passion is basically building applications.
Yeah, totally. I mean, that was definitely the case for me. I saw it and I was like, oh, like, let me play around with this. And I think that's the case for a lot of the early Ethereum folks. They saw a new set of primitives to work with and they came up with all sorts of stuff. And I mean, there was a lot of nonsense that came out of last year, but I think that's how you get to the more important apps that come out of Ethereum.
What was the nonsense? you don't have to say it by name, but you know, this is a debate that Aaron and I have been having for the past, I would say, month or so since Augur launched. And you know, we did two episodes about Augur. And we even made an Augur market, and we put in an Augur bet.
Well, we still have our P-Tape market, which I would like to say thank you to our friends over at CoinDesk who included our P-Tape market in the roundup of the weirdest Augur markets, which has attracted a lot more energy and attention. The market is still live. It runs until the end of the first Trump term. So get on there, sink that node, and bet on our market. We need to get some rep, baby. Sorry, go ahead.
But Tony, one thing that we've been talking about, because you know I have a lot, the only thing that I have a lot of experience in is gambling, and so I know quite a bit about prediction markets. And so when Augur launched, I was very excited. And I would say even before Augur launched, really part of the reason why I was interested in crypto is because, and Ethereum particularly, because it seemed like it might be sort of innovative ways to gamble that get around some of the problems of gambling that happen when you have a bookie system or even an offshore sports book. And the one thing that we've been discussing is whether or not Ethereum itself is really ready to handle products like Augur, which should seemingly be pretty simple. Like, in your experience, is that true? Like, are you running up against limitations in Ethereum itself and the Ethereum network as somebody who programs for Ethereum or you know, works with Ethereum to try and build products? Like, what's the biggest challenge you have?
Other people to program products.
Sure. What's the biggest challenge, like, in terms of just functionality? Like, why is something like Augur, why is it so hard for us to sign on to it? Like, you don't have to impugn or like slander Augur itself, but like, is there something technologically that is a bottleneck or is causing problems?
Yeah, well, I think there are a couple concepts embedded in that question. One's like, why deploy anything on Ethereum? And then two, given something that you deploy to Ethereum, what are some of the like unique challenges that you have to face, and then as a developer, and then maybe three, like as a user, why is it so freaking hard to use any of these things? And so I think first, like Augur is a great example. It's one of those things that really can't exist without the blockchain, because you know some of them it's legal reasons, some of it's it's mostly legal reasons.
Yeah, mostly legal reasons
because it's illegal. Yeah.
I
think that's fair. Jay said that the thing that got him interested in the first place is gambling, which is illegal. Yeah. We wouldn't be talking about this if it was really easy to legally gamble, which maybe it will be in the future. But
right. And you know, illegal activities are an easy target to pick on. But I think it's a subset of things that are not really possible, or somebody would prefer to do it without trusting some person moderating all of it.
So that's
kind of like when I think about should something exist on the blockchain, it's like, okay, well, is there an adequate like substitute that is operating in a censorable way, and are people fine with that? And if it's yes, then like maybe it's not really that needed. But with Augur, you know, it's like pretty clearly needed for some set of people that want to make these markets, and it extends beyond just degenerate gambling on various topics. Things like, you know.
Hey. My fifth question is, why are you gambling so much?
Okay, so what about the second question, which is it possible to build these things on Ethereum?
Yeah, I think the answer is like an obvious yes, because like it exists. So like empirically, there are a lot of things that have been built, and Augur is pretty complicated from a smart contract perspective. And as I understand it, it's largely due to security concerns, because you need to make it so that it's not easily gamed by other people, and that your funds are not at risk to like technical vulnerabilities in the smart contract code or whatever. And then that itself is challenging, but then the Augur team needs to throw away their control of the smart contracts, like throw away the keys, so to speak. And because they have to do that, they have to be super, super sure that it's in really good shape before they throw it away. And part of the reason like they particularly have to throw it away is because in order to continue having it run, they can't be the point of failure if some guy comes and says, shut this down. Like they have to be able to say, I can't. And so that's part of the reason why what they've built is both possible, but also very challenging.
It reminds me of like someone like setting up like an elaborate set of rules for like a Easter egg hunt, where it's like everyone's got to be blindfolded and walk backward, and like we can't like tell you whether the eggs are really there yet or not. Like, you have to like look all over the place for them, you know.
It's
like not impossible, but it's like, okay, you're making it really hard.
Yeah, and it's got to be perfect.
Yeah, and we have to set up the system now to work into the future. Without
totally.
Like, breaking compatibility, which for most software applications is just like, oh God, that sounds like a pain in the ass. Like, at least let me patch it.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, if you've ever worked in a modern technology startup, it's the completely opposite approach where you just ship out something really crappy full of bugs.
Yeah.
But the stakes are pretty low. So you just iterate on that. It's like the complete inverse of that.
Yeah. I mean, I think Jay at least gets frustrated by the state of it. And I think it's a totally valid criticism. Like if you shipped Augur as a normal software product, I'd be like, do not hire that team. They're very bad at their jobs. They're not good at making products. There's no FAQ here. The node just doesn't really sync most of the time. And then I try and defend it in this like weird way where I'm like, it's so hard. But I do recognize that.
Well, no. Okay. To be fair, my problem wasn't that Augur was full of bugs. Like my problem was that they were taking large amounts of people's money and not telling people that it was full of bugs. And
yes.
that was a problem that I had. Like if they had just given everybody, let's say 200 rep and the entire market ran on sort of play money, and that was the way that they were doing it, and it failed all the time, that would be totally fine with me. And I would have really expected it.
You'd immediately be like, all right, come on. I want to bet some real money.
Yeah, that is true.
You'd have no interest in Augur if it was fake money.
I would have. Out of it, but you know, like there, like stuff like I will say stuff like Zynga Poker, you know, which is a iPhone app game that is entirely run off free money. I mean, that's a huge app, you know, and it's actually had some pretty fascinating weird inflation problems that have happened because it's all play money. But you know, I actually just think as a way to just figure out how these things work and whether or not what types of markets people will make, I wouldn't have had a problem with that. It was really just the fact that a lot of people, including us, you know, the only reason why you and I didn't put in more money into the Will Ethereum crash market, which, by the way, we should have done very good.
Shouts to us on our Ethereum under $500 January 1st bet.
Yeah, because you wouldn't listen to me when I was like, no, let's bet more. But, you know, my problem with it was really just that people were putting their own money into it. Not that it didn't work. Like it was just that at a point where they were asking people to put a lot of money in, I just felt like it should have been more functional. That was my issue.
I mean, I think that it's like a pretty interesting, like thinking about the user's experience here is pretty interesting because Augur just shipped a set of smart contracts. They didn't have a website that you logged into and like really use. You have to run all of it yourself.
Yeah.
And they're relying on other people to build front ends using their protocol. And then some of the bugs might be because of the way that the front end implemented it. Some of it might be because of the way the software you're using to run your node. Some of it might just be like, I don't know, some random bug with your computer or your internet or something. But when like we're used to like playing with an app and being like, oh, Facebook sucks for having this super long load time when I'm trying to send this emoji. And you're like usually right in blaming Facebook for that. But here there are just so many different parts of the stack that could fail for whatever reason. And it might not even be a bug. It might just be like, you know, a syncing problem, but it leads to a kind of bad experience. So these are all some of the challenges that everybody's facing in delivering end user experiences.
I want to talk about an article you wrote recently. The article is called We Can't All Be Friends, Crypto and the Psychology of Mass Movements. And this issue I think we're talking about here actually speaks to mass movements. You kind of have to just believe in Ethereum to believe in Augur. Like you have to just sort of believe all this stuff is going to somehow work. And I found that it can separate. Like you described this idea of tribes within crypto, which I think is probably the most accurate way for an outsider who doesn't follow this stuff to understand like what the difference between like an Ethereum and a Bitcoin person is.
Yeah, totally. I mean, if you go to Thanksgiving dinner last year, you know, maybe there was one dude at the table that was really into crypto and everybody else at the table that wasn't was just like, oh, this weirdo that's really into these tokens, right?
Yeah.
And they can't discern between like, is this person really into Bitcoin or are they really into Ethereum or some other random thing or some narrative around like open finance or whatever.
Yeah.
But once you look inside, it's like there are all these really kind of ossified groups of people that are really, really passionate about their beliefs and the people around them and the projects they support. It's quite strange to observe. And they sometimes behave in these really erratic and seemingly irrational ways, which can be I mean, I'm really interested what it's like for somebody who's just getting into crypto for the first time to show up on crypto Twitter and see all the weird stuff going on.
That was us like 1 year ago. That was us like 14 months ago.
Before like figuring out like what was going on with Augur, our main, I would say that our recurring talking point was us trying to figure out if the type of tribalism that you're talking about, which I think is different than the type of quote unquote tribalism that everybody talks about in larger politics right now, you know, in the sense that like these communities, I think it's sort of an exaggerated version of a lot of it, whether or not that was going to be a deterrent for people to get into crypto, because the way in which we saw the path of people who got into crypto sort of getting their information ultimately did follow some of the same pathways. Like there wasn't at that time, there wasn't like a New York Times or a CNN or like a highly produced, almost neutral site that people would have to go to. Like everybody went on Reddit, everybody went on Twitter, and ultimately you would find yourself surrounded by a bunch of people who were screaming at each other in ways that you didn't quite understand. And, you know, at that time, I felt at least that, you know, that this was a problem, that there were a lot of people who were getting into crypto around, you know, the fall of last year, who wanted no part of these types of conversations, especially around the 2x fork. You know, like if they came in and they looked at what the landscape was, they would just assume that everybody was fucking crazy. and Aaron just felt like maybe it didn't matter as much. Aaron could probably explain his perspective more than me, but that's why I found the article that you wrote pretty interesting. Not because I think that you like sort of confirmed or didn't confirm that sort of thought, but that you saw the same sorts of tribes and sort of tried to explain how they had formed.
I think my main insight from that line of thought was I read this book by Eric Hoffer on mass movements, and I realized that like there's been a long study on these phenomenon throughout history. It's not just a crypto phenomenon. And typically some set of people write some subversive pieces or give some subversive talks, and then it kind of stirs the pot and offers some kind of future that's better than the one today. Then some dude or dudette stands on a box and says like, come join me in this revolution, and package up all those ideas. And then people that are really susceptible to these mass movements, and not everybody is, but people that are start to rally around this, and they behave in these kind of predictable ways. And if you use that lens to observe what's happening in crypto, it's pretty complementary. I mean, the getting into crypto at all is like a pretty weird thing to do.
Yeah.
And you have to justify it. It's like, it's kind of like being vegan, you know? You have to like go around and explain to all your friends why you care about these like magic tokens that much. But it's all rooted in these kind of foundational texts around freedom and self-sovereign everything, and like taking power away from governments and authoritarians and all of these people that abuse their power. But then once you get into the crypto mass movement, there are all these sub mass movements that prioritize different things, like the Ripple people care about banking infrastructure, Bitcoin people care about sound money, Ethereum like world computer, and there's all these different subsets of it. But because mass movements compete with each other for adherence, and people that are susceptible to mass movements tend to can switch teams quite frequently, there's this kind of meta war inside of crypto of all these different tribes fighting each other for members. And it's all accelerated by these coin prices.
So I have a question for you about that, because it's actually something, a question that I had while reading your article that I wonder what your opinion on it is, which is that like, I agree that these groups are extremely fungible within crypto, that people tend to switch back and forth. The ways in which you describe their reasons for being into that
club, I accidentally became an eth maximalist this week without even wanting
yeah,
to.
Yeah. I think that I guess that's my idea, which is just that like how much of it is ideology that maybe was part of the person beforehand, and how much of it do you think is just the coin that they got into that spiked when they got into it, if that makes sense. I think the reason why it's so fungible is because I think that the allegiances are pretty shallow. You know, I think the allegiances probably do have to do with whatever coin kind of caught you first. And in that way, it is a little bit like gambling. Like you generally play the game, or you sort of get into the form of gambling that you did well on the first time you did it, you know, and even if you lose at a horrific rate afterwards, you just remember the first time you did well.
Yeah, I think the coin presses definitely confound this whole thing. Or maybe it's just even a direct amplification, because when I think like somebody who's susceptible to a mass movement wants hope in some sudden and spectacular change to their conditions. And I mean, you don't really need too much data for this. If you like watched any of it in 2017, the majority of the retail folks that came in new to crypto like wanted to see some spectacular financial change in their circumstances. And once you, and I think once it starts happening, then you know it's kind of the speculation is like the gateway drug to getting exposure to the actual ideas behind this stuff, and it's hard for somebody who is very strongly prioritizing the financial possibility, like the gambling aspect of this, to be patient enough to really dig into the reasons. And at like a first principles level, think like, does this make sense? Is this valuable? I think it's okay for like a lot of the folks to churn and jump to the next thing because they see a bigger possibility for return, or leave the space altogether when the market turns. But some people, you know, like my colleagues and folks in the industry, like they get in for whatever reason, and then they get exposed to the deeper ideas and they stick around. So you can think of it kind of like a funnel. Over time, as long as those like true believers don't churn out, then you end up growing that core community, which is always there regardless of the market cycle.
I do think it's cultural, though. Like we had on, we were giving Ripple shit on this show. So we had on a true Ripple believer. And he was like a British guy with a background in banking. And he was just like, this is the thing I gravitate to. Like, this is the language I know. This is just my thing. He was like, I was always weirded out because Satoshi's anonymous, you know? Uh-huh. And I think Ethereum people gravitate to Ethereum for cultural, ideological reasons. But I also think that the culture flows back the other direction, which is I've heard a lot more people criticize the fiat inflationary banking system than I remember in the past. There's certainly always been like Ron Paul people in America, but I do think crypto, you know, can, even though there's a tribalism within crypto, it can sort of radicalize a population to ideas like that. Like when people would talk to me and say like, oh, crypto, that's like the tulip bulb thing. I don't find these sort of mania buying things to be a very close corollary. I see like Marxism as a corollary, like an idea that just spreads and gets its tentacles into the world and has this viral capability.
Right. And it's both. And I think that's like, you know, when you talk to folks that feel like Bitcoin might become the like global reserve currency, that's the path that they expect to happen. You have this small core group of people that really believe in that now. And then over time, more and more people get indoctrinated into this idea that Bitcoin is harder money than any of the other money in the world and they should use it. And, you know, voila, over a period of time, now everybody uses it. Because, you know, money is really a shared illusion anyways. It's slips of paper. So if you can get enough people to buy into this ideology, then you have money.
I just have to warn you that anytime someone says money is an illusion on the show, we do insert bong sound effects behind it.
Tony, what do you think in crypto is the inflection point? Like you talk about three stages. You talk about how there's sort of the stage in which a ideology is created, usually by thinkers or philosophers or writers. And then you have a almost like a missionary stage where people are like Antopoulos or Roger Ver are out evangelizing this project. And then you have almost like a capitulation point where enough people are doing this where it becomes an actual thing. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but you don't think that we've reached that point with Bitcoin or Ethereum yet. But what would you imagine is the point where this thing starts to really pick up steam? Because I think a lot of people thought it was last year, you know, when there was so much mania about it. Like, what do you think that would actually look like? Like, is it a price run? Is it a very popular figure sort of getting into crypto? Like, what does this thing look like?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's pretty hard to define, which is kind of a cop-out answer. But, you know, with a mass movement is a mass movement when a mass of people believe it, you know? So yeah. I mean, you could say you just measure based on total population that's behaving in a certain way that's aligned with the mass movement. You could also try to measure it based on like people using these technologies for their intended purpose. Like for Ethereum, you could imagine some set of apps that actually have millions of users, like maybe tens of millions of people use Augur or something, and there are a bunch of other apps like that. Then you'd start to see real contention between this school of thought and the competing schools of thought. Right now, it's like, you know, crypto is kind of a mosquito against the legacy financial technology institutions. It's interesting and people are keeping an eye on it, but there's relatively so little engagement with the technology that it's just rumblings. And so to use Bitcoin as an example, I think if a few countries started announced that they were accumulating Bitcoin and using that as part of their reserves, that would be pretty reflective of entering this middle stage of the movement.
Sure.
But just people speculating on the price on Coinbase or Binance, I think it'll never really reach real mass movement unless the mass movement is the right way to live is to speculate on random tokens.
We like to talk on the show a lot about the narratives of crypto. I'd say maybe we're more interested than that than anything else. Crypto as literature. And your article is really interesting insofar as thinking about who these leaders map to. In the fanatical movement world, you have leaders like Lenin, Gandhi, you have Trump listed here, and this is the fanatic leader who galvanizes the right population. And the two biggest figures being Satoshi and Vitalik, we couldn't have asked for a more operatic contrast between the two of them. How do you think this mass movement model, looking at Ethereum and Bitcoin as the two major strands, what does the mass movement model tell us about the difference between a leaderless and an anonymous and a messianic figure movement?
Yeah, it is very fascinating. And you see with Bitcoin, people try to backfill and be that messiah. And
yeah.
It leads to all sorts of drama, right? People claim they're Satoshi and they try to move the Bitcoin community in their direction to serve their needs.
Are you familiar with Excerptoshi? He's a figure we're trying to popularize on the show. He's a person who purports to be Satoshi Nakamoto and is publishing a memoir about founding Bitcoin. He's been putting out these cryptic messages from the Nakamoto Family Foundation. No one takes him seriously except us.
Half our show content. Wait,
it's a real person?
It's a real person, and he's put out excerpts from the book, and they have all these weird tantalizing details in them, but absolutely no proof, and the book isn't out. He just keeps revealing these little bits of it and cryptograms on his website. Anyway, we are currently pushing his candidacy as the backfill candidate.
that sounds like Satoshi, I'm convinced.
Yeah.
Yeah, thank you. That was our point.
Which every time we start talking about this, we go off course.
It takes half hours.
You were talking about the non-excerptoji Satoshi.
Well, it sounds like they're one and the same. So yeah, Satoshi excerpt. But yeah, I mean, people try to fill that vacuum and be the figurehead and move the community in one direction or the other. I think a single person hasn't really succeeded in doing that. But there is this quorum of folks that all kind of agree with each other in general that seem to have a lot of influence in the community and at least have power over the direction of protocol changes.
So if we can't get Jesus, we've at least got the apostles.
That's right. But in contrast, Vitalik, it clearly plays a very important role in the Ethereum community, but I don't think he would characterize himself as the leader, as crazy as that sounds. And I think he actually...
That's how it always works in a cult. Actually, he does not want to be called guru. People have just been calling him guru.
Yeah, it's like how Edward Sharpe was not the lead singer of the Magnetic Zeros, even though the band was called Edward Sharpe and the Magnetic Zeros.
Yeah. Vitalik is doing a great job of accidentally convincing people he's a leader. If he got run over by a bus tomorrow, I think that would be the end of Ethereum as we know it. He's as closely linked in his very soul to the project as a person can be, I feel like.
I think the one innovation that was in your piece that I found, you know, and I think that I'm not like, I think the right, the term innovation is correct, because it did make me think of crypto in a different way, which is that you seem to think that more than a group of technologies that exist sort of in a vacuum, that what the crypto space has become is a set of social movements almost, you know, that Ethereum is a technology, but more than that, it is sort of a movement of people that are following one ideology, just as Bitcoin for the types of people like Saifedean Ammous or all the people who don't eat vegetables and only eat meat. Like
the, what's that, up with that? Why is there such a huge overlap between these communities?
Okay, so going back to what Aaron and I were asking, this is a completely unrelated question, but you know,
I like how earlier you're like, it's like choosing to be vegan. It's like both like choosing to be vegan or to only eat steak. They're both similar character
what
choices.
What is with that? I mean, like, I was hoping you would know, because like we've never really been able to figure it out, except that both are kind of like hardcore ideas, I think.
Yeah, well,
basically saying like society has been lying to us all the time.
I do
vegetables.
I do think it's, I mean, you can explain it with this idea that people that are into mass movements are this certain type of person that's into lots of mass movements, not just technology or social ones, but also maybe dietary ones.
It's all an all-encompassing type of thing where you feel like all of society has lied to you about everything your entire life, and therefore why not question like what you're also eating, you know, if you're questioning what money is. I guess the question that I have is that I don't disagree with your characterization of it, and the thing that I'm interested in is whether or not you think that these things sort of have to be by definition antagonistic towards one another. You know, does Ethereum have to be at war with Bitcoin? Like, obviously, the Bitcoin maximalists, like Saifedean Ammous, like, they're extremely, I don't even think intolerant is the right word. They almost have, like, they would like to exterminate the Ethereum movement, and they would like to exterminate.
Whoa, Jay.
I mean, I think you're using the appropriate language.
Like, I don't think it's...
No, you're right.
He says, like, I want these things to not exist anymore.
Yeah.
You know, everyone who is involved with them is stupid and destroying my movement. Like, those are they're not actual quotes from him, but do you feel like they must be antagonistic towards one another?
It can't be helped. The reason is, if you just think about the incentives, there are always going to be incentives for people to try to create things that enrich them. And in this space, that means generating a new token and trying to make that go up in value. And as a result, if you, assuming that there's like a fixed amount of attention or capital or whatever resource you can think of in the industry, then you're competing with everybody else for that same resource. And so you see it come out way more in bear markets than bull markets. And that, for that reason, like, there's this feeling of scarcity of developers and supporters, capital, attention, like all this kind of stuff. And if those scarce resources are allocated or even just distributed to other people, that means it's not going to your project, which decreases the likelihood that your mass movement wins out in the long term. So it's game theoretically sound to do this, but it's like a very unpleasant vibe.
It's the right game theory, but it's not a cool thing to do at a party. You know how like Nassim Taleb always has that thing about like, you should go to a party because it's like a high opportunity event with like a low like cost or whatever. And it's just like, that's exactly the opposite person you want at a party. Someone who's talking about the like opportunity value of going to a party. Yeah, I tend to think, Jay, that the Marxist parable bears out. It's like saying like, hey, why can't these Stalinites just let these Trotskyites be? Why do they got to keep trying to exterminate them over there? As long as all of these things exist at once, the flippening in any direction is always going to be like possible. And I also mean like the cultural flippening, the like, what is the thing of these that is the most capturing of the hearts and minds?
Yeah, I think the question that I'm interested in, I don't really have a good mental model for, is whether this is net positive for crypto as a movement or negative.
Oh yeah, like, that was the central question of the first 3 months of CoinTalk, and Aaron and I really disagreed about it. And I don't know if I was right, or I don't know if Aaron was right. That we thought about what I thought it was a net negative. And the reason why was because I felt like for it, and I actually don't believe this anymore, but I still sort of agree with myself, but for different reasons. But I just felt that the types of people that I knew who were trying to get into crypto, that there would be a point where they would come across this toxicity and that they would be turned off by it. And that the messaging of crypto...
Right into the arms of Ripple.
It was just, well, that, sure, but it, like, you know, like, but the guy that we talked to who really liked Ripple, I mean, that was his actual narrative. You know, he was just like, crypto is too toxic of a space. It was too outlandish. The revolution that they wanted, we didn't want. And Aaron and I both, you know, we both hold some Bitcoin. And we both are obviously interested in crypto. But neither of us actually think that a Bitcoin hypercoinization or whatever is a good thing for the world. Like, we think it's a terrible, it would be a terrible thing for the world if the ideas of people like Saifedean Ammous were across the world. And so I felt like that this type of competition, this sort of tribalism that you talked about, had made all the messages so severe and had made them so angry because they were mostly led by people who are, you know, like sort of, I guess, zealots in some sort of way, that this was going to be ultimately a turnoff, and that you could talk about Bitcoin all you wanted in Bloomberg or CNBC or something like that. And you could try and present a technological or interesting thing, but at some point people would sort of find the beating heart of it and it would be like this toxic fighting. And that I thought that that was bad.
But, people love toxic fighting in this country.
That's true. Well,
that's our most popular entertainment product.
That's why I've been mostly trying to, that's why I've been wondering if I was wrong, because, you know, I mean, Aaron and I spend most of our podcast time now just talking and laughing about that type of stuff. We're like highly entertained by it, you know, and that I think that's sort of helped hold our interest through what has been an extended bear market.
Yeah, I mean, anecdotally, I haven't really met anybody who has at least positioned themselves as some kind of true believer in any aspect of crypto who has like actually left. There are a few people who have quit Twitter for like 8 hours and then come back.
I'm on 4 months. No, 3 months. three months now.
Whoa.
Yeah.
That's impressive.
He's got a powerful spite factor, though.
Tony, where do you lean? Do you think that it's a problem or not a problem?
I think you can't divorce it from the market cap of crypto. If the market cap continues to go down until it's zero, it doesn't matter. Like, nobody's going to join in the revolution.
Sure.
No one's going to go join your broke-ass revolution.
Yeah, exactly. I got a job to do. If it goes up, then I think it's a good thing. Because it's kind of like there's a meme in the community that these corrections are for building and improving the technology. But it's also a time to like refine the messaging and figure out what's resonating and what's more accurate. And it's kind of like sharpening your swords swords is probably not the right way to welcome.
It's like getting out your long knives and waiting for the revolution.
But you know what I mean? It's like decorating the house for the housewarming when new people come in attracted by some upcycle in the market. So I think it's probably good, because evolution and anarchy and all of these things make you more fit to survive. That's kind of how I view it. I think if there's a silver lining to this toxic like infighting, it's that it leads to people having more conviction in the messaging and clearer messages to give to people that are coming in.
Would you want to live in the no vegetables, only eat meat Bitcoin world?
I don't know. I really don't. And that's the third phase of the mass movement. When you've gotten everybody on board, you've like started this new way of doing things, and inevitably it's like, sure, we overthrew the government, but we don't have running water now. And like, how do I convince these people that that's a good thing?
like Bitcoin,
all this frozen steak, but no water.
Yeah, it's really hard to predict that far out. But I think if you think about it just from like, let's reduce power from authoritarians and give it to people, then you should expect that freedoms increase overall, and more freedom is good because people are happier when they're more free. But then you're like, oh, well, if everything's Bitcoin, then like all of our financial systems aren't going to work the same way. A lot of stuff's going to break. It's going to be like a way worse version of Y2K. That might not be great. You know, I think, and maybe more importantly, is if we do reach a point where the it's starting to crest, and you're seeing these kind of crypto revolutions bump up against traditional systems like legal governments, etc. They're not just going to be like, all right, you win, this is better. There's going to be an awkward transition period.
Oh yeah, I mean, I think that there will be like a full attempt to just wipe it off the face of the earth. I mean,
people don't like uprisings.
And also, a lot of people with a lot of power and money would no longer have that power and money, and they would be looking at a world where, you know, the Winklevi owned 1% of the world's wealth or something like that. Yeah, totally. Like, that sounds terrible.
I mean, this is kind of was my kind of, I guess, I don't really think me and Jay disagreed about it. This, we maybe just look at the darkness in two different ways, which is, I think it's a confirmation that crypto is a dangerous idea. The fact that it like operates like a mass movement like this, to me, suggests that it could potentially have the same kind of earth-changing effect of a true mass movement, where a total reformation of society, currency outside of national borders, seems like within the grasp of people who are this ideological and motivated. To me, that's not a entirely good thing, but I guess I like take it seriously.
Yeah, totally. And I think the end state is less undesirable than the transition state. Like, the transition state is, if we get to that point, is what I'm most uncomfortable about. But if we get to a point where, yeah, most people are using Bitcoin for money, I think there will be some inconveniences, like, as we get adjusted. But overall, it should be better.
So the transition phase is, like, when most of the Monero hits will happen.
Yeah.
Or I think it's, like, when, like, the government will send you to the gulags forever. Yeah.
Exactly.
When the last vegetable goes extinct from this earth. And we go through extensive bee-free education. That part of the history, right?
We stopped growing vegetables because we wanted to only eat beef, and then forgot that cows had to eat vegetables, and now we're out of cows too.
Oh yeah. Oh, that would be that would be the saddest extinction story ever.
Tony, what excites you right now in crypto? Like, what is capturing your attention?
I think it's the developers coming in and building a bunch of stuff.
Yeah.
You know, last year there was a wave of developers that could tolerate all of the pains of building on top of blockchains, and they made some kind of interesting stuff, but we learned a lot of it doesn't work that great. And now I feel like the space is like way more intelligent about what might be useful and usable. So seeing all of that is like really, really exciting. And I am hopeful that we're going to get to the end of the year and start seeing some really exciting like applications that people use and don't complain about the way that Jay complained about Augur.
To be fair, Jay's probably going to give a lot of things a bad review.
Yeah. I mean, I did like CryptoKitties. Tony, what were the things that were built last year that excited you? Like, what were some of the exciting projects that have happened in the last, like, let's say 6 months or so?
Yeah, I mean, this may be boring, but the infrastructure stuff is what's been most exciting to me. Like, scaling solutions for Ethereum that will make the transaction cost kind of trivial and the throughput as fast as you need it to be for whatever app you have. That resolves a lot of the problems people were having with building apps on blockchains.
Sure.
UX stuff, like making crypto more invisible to end users, so you can like go to a website or download an app and just use it pretty similar to how you would any other app. You don't have to like go save a private key and go onto Coinbase first to get some Ethereum and then transfer it to this other account and like all this kind of stuff. I think abstracting that away is going to be huge. But both kind of fall in this general theme of like, let's make this stuff usable and get stuff out to actual users that don't really care that much about maybe the mission yet, and have that be the Trojan horse for them to get brought into some of these more idealistic things.
That's a very good answer. Very sensible. And I'm wondering if Aaron right now is trying to buy more Ethereum.
No, I already have too much. You're in a kind of like unique, like there can't be that many people in this country who do what you do, like actually like build, you know, working in product teams, building this kind of stuff. Is this like a growing field, or like college students studying to work on this kind of stuff?
Definitely on the engineering side. Every major computer science program, I think, has some courses on blockchain now.
Wow. That was fast.
Yeah. And it's really, this is, at least Ethereum feels very bottoms up. I mean, the whole thing feels pretty bottoms up. I mean, it's by design. You just have this organic interest in like learning how this stuff works and what they can put on it. So just like with mobile, there's going to be a few years where there's a massive shortage of people with expertise to make any of this stuff. But very quickly, people are coming up to speed. The community of developers is growing really fast. On the product side, though, like very, very, very tiny, tiny, tiny community. So not a huge industry around product function in crypto, but that's starting to change. A lot of teams have been coming to me asking for recommendations on how to hire, and there just really aren't that many people with experience here yet. So, and I feel like it's a huge need, because sooner or later, we're going to need to get to a point where like things are actually good and usable and attractive to end users. And that's kind of, you know, designing things in such a way that people want to use them is a big role for product people. So I think it'd be really good for the space if there were more product people.
Tony, I've really enjoyed your writing. People can find it. It's all at tonysheng.com.
Yeah, that's right.
And I also very much enjoy your newsletter. So everyone should go there and sign up. You had actually, I was going to talk about the most recent newsletter you sent out, which was about a history of the term decentralized, how much it appeared at various times in the pre-Bitcoin writings. That was really interesting. So I encourage everyone to check that out.
Do it.
Thanks so much for the interview.
Thanks, guys. Yeah, great meeting. This was fun.
Hey, thanks, Tony.
This episode of Coin Talk was taped Wednesday, September 5th at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. The Bitcoin price index was $6,686.
Thanks to Tony Sheng. Thanks to Jay Kang. Thanks to our editor, James Nicholson. Thanks to our friends at Medium who helped make the show possible. All our episodes are at medium.com/cointalk, and our email is hi@cointalk.show.